This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Bush plans to press for a reform of the Social Security system in his second term. Last week, he described the current system as near insolvency. If you're 20 years old and you're beginning to work, the president said, I want you to think about a Social Security system that will be flat bust, bankrupt, unless the United States Congress has got the willingness to act now. Critics say the president is exaggerating the problem. With so much back and forth on the subject already, and much more to come, not to mention outright confusion, we want to try to answer your questions about Social Security today, how much trouble it's in, and about proposals to fix it, and how these proposed changes might affect you. Later, we'll hear two views on whether the system is in dire trouble or not, but first, we want to answer your questions. If you want to know more about the retirement age, taxes, caps, benefits, trust funds, or about the assumptions used to project how the system will be doing 10, 25, or 75 years from now, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll hear from advocates, but joining us first is Eugene Sterley. He's senior fellow at the Urban Institute, co-editor of Social Security and the Family. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Good to be here, Neil.
And before we get to listeners' questions, I know the president has not disclosed any details of his ideas, but what are the key changes that President Bush hopes to see in a reformed Social Security system?
Well, the two major items that his commission, a commission he appointed earlier in his first term, put forward were, one, to try to promote individual accounts, that is to have some portion of the Social Security tax go into accounts which would represent savings that would be held fairly directly by the taxpayer, although invested in a limited series of funds. And the second one, the second major element of those proposals was to slow down the rate of growth in benefits, essentially by letting them grow only at the rate of growth of inflation, but not the rate of growth of wages. Now, what that means in the latter case is that, whereas in the current system, if your income is, say, a third higher than your parents, you could expect to get roughly a third higher annual benefits. That would say that's no longer true. Roughly, we'd keep benefits for you and your parents about the same.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's the feeling about this? Again, no legislation has been drafted as yet, but what's the feeling about this in Congress? Even some Republicans we've heard express skepticism that the Social Security system is in crisis.
Well, when you ask me about Congress, you're asking me more about politics than you are economics. And, you know, in politics, the problem is nobody wants to identify who's going to pay for government, who's going to be a loser if you reform a system. And so on the one side, we have a group who essentially wants to say there's no problem in the current system, or we can just delay when we have to deal with it, even though we know that it's going further and further out of balance and eating up larger and larger shares of the budget. On the opposite side, we have people who want to say, well, you know, if we just make a few of these changes like individual accounts, somehow or another, money might magically grow on trees and we don't have to deal with the problem either, or it's really not going to be a problem only if we make this fix. In truth, somebody has to pay.
When you say money might matter, in other words, some people hope to grow their way out of this, that there would be so much more money coming in that this wouldn't cease to be a problem.
Well, the argument is if we put money in individual accounts, indeed, we might save more. And indeed, that is a possibility. And even, you know, President Clinton, in one form, backed individual accounts, although he didn't want to take the money out of Social Security. Mm-hmm. But in order to grow more, we have to save more. In order to save more, we have to put more money aside. We either have to put more money aside now by taxing people more or by cutting benefits somewhere. So essentially, whatever we get, we have to pay for.
Okay, let's get to some listeners' questions. Over the last week, we've solicited you to send in email questions, but we'd also welcome questions today. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK, and the email address, as always, is TOTN@npr.org. And Gene Sterley, Steve in Modesto, California, writes to ask, we keep hearing that there were 16 workers to one retiree when Social Security was passed. This, of course, back in the Roosevelt administration, back in the New Deal. Yet it's three workers per one now. What other factors in the original contract have changed?
Well, I think that's a very good question because, in fact, Stephen is identifying the major problem facing Social Security. That is, the major cause of whatever imbalance we face is demographically based. We can argue about how we're going to finance things and whether we're on individual accounts, but it's essentially this decline in workers. to retirees. And we have coming up, as the baby boomers start retiring, a decline scheduled from 3 workers per retiree to 2 workers per retiree. Now, remember, the system is basically what is called a pay-as-you-go system. The workers' taxes essentially, for the most part, go out to pay the workers. And so the problem facing the system is, what do we do if the $3 that used to finance one retiree's benefit now is reduced to $2? Do we bump up the taxes we impose upon the worker, or do we cut down the rate of growth of the benefits that's promised to the retiree? Those demographic factors are really the principal change affecting the system, and all the rest of it, in some sense, is noise.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Marilyn, who's with us from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Hello.
Hi, Marilyn. You're on the air.
Okay. My question is that I thought President Nixon put Social Security in the budget when he was in office to balance it out. And if it's in budget, are people borrowing from it at the government level? And if they are borrowing from it, is that why Social Security's in trouble?
Marilyn, thanks very much. Jean, I think we have to begin by explaining. I think she's talking about the Social Security Trust Fund. What is that,
yes,
first of all?
Right. The trust fund is that fund into which the taxes that are paid by the Social Security taxes are put aside to pay for Social Security benefits. Now, mind you, that for the vast...
This is when the system is in surplus, when it's taking in more money than it's paying out.
That's right. But the system has never really had much more than a very, very modest surplus. You know, for instance, the liabilities of the system are well in excess of $10 trillion. Maybe today it has assets of $1 to $2 trillion. There's always been only a very modest amount put in the trust fund. The trust fund, however, has kept along the notion that the taxes, the Social Security taxes, should pay for the system. And to some extent, they have over its past history. Mm-hmm. They won't in the future.
Now, what about Marilyn's question? Is that money, the Social Security Trust Fund, how is that being used by every administration since Richard Nixon's?
Well, it's actually been used by every administration since Franklin Roosevelt. Essentially, very early in the creation of the system, it was decided that we wanted to get money immediately to people who are elderly. If we're going to give money to people who are elderly who haven't saved for the retirement, then we're going to take those tax dollars and immediately transfer them over. So essentially, the system has had very little in the way of saving. Now, what did happen in a recent reform, that is the 1983 reform, which followed along some nice reforms in the 1970s, there was a decision to build up a very modest trust fund. But again, I want to emphasize it was very, very modest. And even that buildup, which reaches its peak right now as the baby boomers are in the workforce, even that buildup was spent down in the sense that we then ran larger deficits in the rest of the budget.
Mm-hmm. But where is that money?
The money has essentially been paid out to retirees, or if you want to count the slight surplus, it's been paid out to pay for other government programs.
So the government has borrowed against that trust fund.
It's less that it borrowed against the trust fund than it ran larger deficits outside the trust fund.
But
it wasn't saving. The government was not saving for the future.
I'm confused. Is there somewhere, if there's $1.5 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund, are there somewhere pieces of paper where I owe you, federal government, to Social Security Trust Fund?
That's right. One side of the government issues a bond, and the other side of the government holds the bond.
Okay. Marilyn, I'm still confused, but we'll move on. Thanks very much for the phone call. Here's a email from Jude in Edgewater, Colorado. What exactly is the difference between President Bush's new proposal and the old tax-deferred IRA system? A citizen can choose how much to invest, can choose where to put it, and can put more or less interest on the principal depending on the state of the market. I put my money into IRA CDs. I earned between 2% when the market was low, 5 or 6% when the market was high.
Well, let me be clear. The president, again, has not backed any specific proposal. Even the ones I mentioned earlier were only ones put forward by his commission. He has, however, indicated strong sympathy towards individual accounts. And in many ways, they are like an individual retirement account. That is, one would have money in this account. The two main differences are, one, that one would be mandated to participate in it. That is, the Social Security tax that used to pay to go current beneficiaries would now go into your account. So some portion of your Social Security tax would go into this IRA-like account. The other difference is, because in many cases there would be only a very modest amount of money in the account, you really would have very limited choices on how to allocate the money. The government is afraid, as well as any private Wall Street firm that might be hired, is afraid to incur too much administrative cost for what could be end up being very small accounts in many cases.
Mm-hmm. Now, if this, I guess, is a pretty fundamental question. The money in Social Security that I pay my Social Security taxes, it goes to pay my father's Social Security, let's say. If some of that money is now being tucked away into an IRA, isn't there going to be a shortfall?
That's right. Let's suppose that of your $10 that you're putting aside, $9 is going to your father and a dollar is going into this trust fund very temporarily. But in the long run, the $10 you're paying isn't even enough to pay for your father. So at some point, you're going to pay in $10, but your father's promised $11, and that's in the very near future. Now, all of a sudden, we take away from your $10, we take another couple dollars away, and we put it into an account. Well, now all of a sudden, you've only got $8 aside to pay for this $11. And that indeed is the dilemma that's facing the reformers, not just how to pay for the shortfall in the current system, but if we adopt individual accounts, how are we going to pay for those?
And it, just to extend the conversation back to that trust fund, $3, the missing $3, well, that could come out of the trust fund, but that means the government's got to pay that from somewhere else.
Well, there's not enough of the trust funds to last for very long. So you're right. It basically has to come from somewhere else. And in fact, the system already, if you count all the Medicare and Social Security systems as a whole, including what is called the doctor's portion of Medicare, we're already paying substantial amounts out of the general revenues, that is out of income taxes and taxes beyond Social Security taxes, to pay for elderly programs.
This is Gene Sterley, and he's a senior fellow at the Urban Institute, co-editor of Social Security and the Family. We're answering your questions about Social Security. Is it in crisis? When will it be in crisis? What about the various proposals to try to fix the problem? Does the system need a fundamental reform, or could some modest tweaks get us around what could be a problem? If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're trying to answer your questions today about how proposed changes in Social Security would affect you and your retirement. If you have questions about the system as it is or as it might be, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Eugene Sterley, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute and co-editor of Social Security and the Family. Here's an email question from Steve in Muncie, Indiana. If the demographic change is the issue, how does removing younger workers from the system help this problem? It would seem to make it worse.
Well, again, younger workers aren't removed from the system. There is an argument by the opponents of individual accounts that the money younger workers would be putting into the system would now be put aside into their own accounts and less would be available to transfer to older workers. And that is indeed true. And most reform proposals which put money in individual accounts gradually then reduce the rate of increase in benefits that these younger workers would get. That is, they get the individual account, but then they're going to get a paired level of automatically promised benefit.
Rob in Oakland, California asks, what would happen to those who make bad investments? Where is their safety net? Do they deserve money? What if the stock market crashes?
Again, if there's money in individual accounts, just like in private pensions, that would put a risk upon the holder of the account. There's no doubt about that. The dilemma, of course, is that any saving involves risk. So if we have a system with no saving and no work, we could argue there's no risk because there's no variation in the return.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good question. The question, in fact, the dilemma is how do we allocate the risk adequately between the young and the old? Because the young bear the risk of a depression just as much as do the old, whether it's a stock market crash or unemployment or any other economic factor.
Let's talk now with Jerry. Jerry's calling from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I love your program.
Thank you.
I just have a simple question, I think. I'm 60 years old. I'll be 61 in May. I am planning on retiring very shortly, and at 62, collecting my Social Security. I've heard hours worth of rhetoric on this subject, but nobody has really, at least in my estimation, made it clear to me if I will have or can expect Social Security benefit for the rest of my days.
Gene Sterling?
Well, there's no promise that's absolutely sure, but I feel fairly confident in saying, yes, you can. We get Social Security benefits for the rest of your days. But let me add the following factor. If you retire at 62, and I don't know whether you're married or not, but let's say you had a spouse who was 62. The two of you would be living off Social Security benefits for 25 years. That's how long a typical 62-year-old couple is now expected to receive benefits.
For how long?
For 25 years, that is, males 62 have life expectancies of 17 years, females 20, and the longer living the two, because one usually doesn't make it to the life expectancy, is about 25 years.
Okay.
That's a long time to be dependent upon Social Security, and the principal risk that people your age take is actually dropping out of the workforce altogether. I'm not talking about retiring from a current job or getting Social Security benefits. But dropping out altogether for 25 years is a substantial risk, even if your Social Security benefits are going to be there for you.
But you feel fairly certain, getting back to his question, Congress being responsive to votes by people like Jerry, and there's going to be an awful lot of people like Jerry, that he will continue to get benefits. Those benefits that the Social Security system sends out these letters saying, you can expect, if everything goes all right, to get X amount per month when you retire, if you retire at 62 or 65 or 67.
Exactly. It's very simple tables.
That's right. That's right. But I want to be careful about this. I mean, the government often reneges in other ways. You know, in the reforms in the late 70s and early 80s, the system was also overpromised. Benefits were far in excess of taxes. And the question was, how do you allocate the reduction in those promises or the increase in taxes across generations? And to some extent, some of that burden was put on older workers. In that case, for instance, by starting to tax benefits. So yes, the benefit that people 60 or 62 had remained the same in nominal terms, but in fact, for some people, at least at higher income levels, it started becoming taxed. Another thing that could happen if we increase tax rates in the future, we might not impose them only on workers. We might impose a consumption tax or a value-added tax to meet the shortfall, which means you might get the same level of Social Security benefits, but your taxes might have to go up to help pay for the shortfall. Somebody has to pay for the shortfall. And though the politicians are promising older people, I'm about your age, like you and me, that we're going to be off scot-free, that's not necessarily going to be true.
Maybe if I could just ask one follow-up question. I guess my real concern is what President Bush is proposing now going to have an impact other than what you've just explained?
For the most part, no.
Okay.
I think that's a fair summation. The president, again, has not completely detailed what his proposal is, but I think he said that people who are in retirement or about to retire would not be affected by anything he proposed.
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. Let's talk now with Scott, and Scott's joining us on the road from Missouri.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, you're on the air, Scott.
Okay, with a couple hundred million new people opening up these individual accounts, what are they? Nobody talked about the fees that would be involved. Are they, you know, Wall Street's pretty eager to have, you know, 1 or 2% on the dollar for, you know, everybody who's going to have to put in for Social Security. Are they going to limit these fees? Or I know there's no proposal, but
mm-hmm. How would that work? Is this one big organization, or several smaller organizations, or millions of individual accounts, Gene?
Again, there are a variety of proposals out there, but most of the proposals that I have seen to date try to restrict quite severely the number of types of accounts that one could have. Some proposals are for having a broad thrift plan that would be like the federal thrift plan that's gotten by civil service workers that would apply to the nation as a whole. Almost all the proposals have a very restricted set of options in terms of moving assets around. And the main reason is not so much the profits that Wall Street would generate. It's the administrative cost of dealing with all these millions of accounts, responding to questions, responding to people's requests to move assets, dealing with the fact that when people get annuities, they may want different types of annuities. All these types of choices that one makes with savings would then apply to these accounts as well. And so there are a lot of attempts to try to restrict the number of options so as to reduce the administrative cost.
Scott, thanks for the question.
Thanks.
Let's talk now with Robert. And Robert's with us from Grass Valley, California.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay.
Good. My question is, isn't healthcare issues more of an issue than Social Security now at this time for the adults?
That's exactly correct. It's a very good point. The shortfalls in Medicare are far in excess of the shortfalls in Social Security, and that's because Medicare has all of the problems of Social Security, plus a cost growth that we haven't been able to get under control.
And there's a room, there's an office that's got file cabinets that has all the receipts from the government for the IOUs for Social Security. Isn't that true?
I don't know if they would say that so much. Basically, there are bonds held by Social Security. As I say, it's sort of as if we as the parents put aside a saving account and we said to some of the young people, you owe us all the money in this savings account multiplied by 10. And meanwhile, we not only had the savings account, which was totally inadequate to cover our liability, our what you owed us, but we ran a big mortgage on the side as well and passed that on to you.
Right.
Thanks, Robert. Here's a question from Susan in Spring Branch, Texas, who would like to know what adjustments have been made in the past to deal with other Social Security crises?
There have been a number of them. At one point, there was a modest reduction in disability benefits as they continue to grow. And by the way, this often isn't even being discussed, but disability insurance payments are also growing at a fairly fast rate. There was, in 1983 reform, a movement towards taxing Social Security benefits so that these benefits, which formerly were non-taxable for income tax purposes, now became taxable as well. There were a number of increases in tax rates over time. The tax rate when Social Security was first established was 2 percentage points of payroll for employees and employees and employers, and then it bumped up to 3, and then to 6, and then to 9.6, then to 12.26, then to 15.3, so the tax rate has gone up. The tax base itself has been expanded over time, although for a variety of other economic factors, it's also been eroding recently. That is the amount of wages that are subject to tax. So there have been a broad range of proposals that have been adopted over time, which have imposed either higher taxes or lower benefits upon the citizens.
Isn't the retirement age slowly increasing as well?
In some sense, it's less that the retirement age is increasing than the benefits have been reduced, and that's somewhat technical. What is called the normal retirement age of 65 is gradually being moved up to 67. But the early retirement age of 62 is not being increased. So what Social Security essentially does is reduce on an actuarial basis the amount of benefits we get. So we get lower benefits at 62 than we otherwise would have gotten. Mm-hmm. Now, if we actually delay our retirement, which, by the way, could be a major way in which we solve the Social Security problem, whether we do it formally by requiring people to work longer or they just start working longer, if we delay our retirement, we get substantially higher benefits because we get such things as a delayed retirement credit that bumps up the benefit we would get.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back and take one more shot at the Social Security Trust Fund, if you would. In a sense, isn't what we've been doing sort of an accounting trick? This money, whenever Social Security has been into a surplus, this money has been used to buy government bonds. The government has counted this money, and correct me if I'm wrong, and theoretically, that money should never have been touched. However, Congress being Congress, government being what it is, they've counted that money as if it were general income. And now they have to pay it back, or they might have to pay it back, and that would, in a sense, add up twice. They wouldn't be able to get it in as income, and they'd have to be paying out.
Well, again, remember, and this is part of the confusion, is the amount that was going to be put in the trust funds, even if it had all been saved, if government had run deficits elsewhere, was a tiny, tiny portion of the liabilities of the system. So in some sense, the trust fund accounting, whether they had saved it or not, is indifferent. But you're right. The government did run large deficits. It did not save the money in the trust funds. If I can make one other analogy here, it'd be as if you set aside in your personal account a little savings account you called your food saving account, and you ignored what was happening in the rest of your budget. And then you got to a point in time where you had a little money in this food saving account. So this entitles me to have food for the rest of my life, regardless of what other liabilities you've run elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, there are a lot of...
But you used it for your car payment.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
All
That's right.
All right. Gene Sterley, thank you very much for being with us today.
Sorry to think
of helping us see through this thicket of numbers, which are difficult on the radio. Gene Sterley is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute, co-editor of Social Security and the Family, and he was with us here in Studio 3A. Now let's turn to the merits and the criticisms of President Bush's plans for Social Security reform. And again, the president has talked very generally about his proposals and has not laid out a specific proposal as yet. We invite your calls during this segment as well. What do you think Social Security in the future should look like, and how should it work? What should be its underlying philosophy? And as always, the number 800-989-8255, email totn@npr.org. With us are Stephen Moore, author of Bullish on Bush, How George W. Bush's Ownership Society Will Make America Stronger. He's also president of a new conservative lobbying group called the Free Enterprise Fund. He's with us from the studios of member station WYPR in Baltimore, and it's nice to have you back on the program.
Good afternoon.
And here in Studio 3A with us is Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, co-author of Social Security, The Phony Crisis. Nice to have you back on the program as well.
Thanks for having me on.
Steve Moore, let's start with you. Is the Social Security system in financial crisis?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. The system is looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 trillion, and that's trillion with a T, in unfunded liabilities. And, of course, what that means is that the system has promised to pay $10 trillion more in benefits than the tax is going to collect. So I liken this to the Titanic that's headed to the iceberg, and we better be smart captains and steer this ship away from the iceberg, or it's going to capsize.
Now, if it's simply a matter of looking at these numbers, and if people agree about these numbers, how can so many people look at the same numbers and arrive at such different conclusions?
I don't know. I mean, I think if you look at every report that's been done for the last 15 years, whether it's, I mean, most importantly, the Social Security accountants themselves say that the system is in very dire financial shape. So I do think it's irresponsible for people to say that there's nothing wrong with the system when you can look at the numbers and just see that once those baby boomers start retiring, and there's something like 65 to 70 million of us, once we start retiring, demographics is destiny, and we're going to be putting huge burdens on our children and our grandchildren.
Now, what the president is believed to be talking about is, again, private accounts based on some percentage of younger workers' Social Security taxes. Some of that money would be theirs. They could invest it in the future. But again, that money would not be available for these sort of IRA-ish kind accounts. So there's going to be so-called transition costs. Is that correct?
That's right. But the way that I look at it, though, is that you borrow, you know, for the next 15 years or so to get out of this hole that we're in, that we've dug ourselves in. But then once these workers who've had these private accounts start to retire, they are going to be getting a substantial amount of their benefits from the private account, not from the Social Security program. And so the future benefits of the program are reduced substantially. And the way I like to look at it is we have two choices. The one is the first scenario we just talked about, where you have we stay on the course we're on right now, and the red ink gets deeper and deeper and deeper after every year. Mm-hmm. And the second course is we borrow now to have a new system that's modernized and that has personal ownership. And in fact, what you get with that system is surpluses that get larger and larger every year. To me, it seems like a simple choice.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, Dean Baker, turning to you, your book is The Phony Crisis. We'll take it from that. You don't think there is a crisis.
Well, I actually rely on the Social Security Trustees report and the reports in the Congressional Budget Office. I love Steve's adjectives and how we represent things. Let's start with the $10 trillion debt with a T, trillion. $10 trillion refers to the estimated shortfall over the infinite future. I don't know many people who think too much about what things look like in 23rd, 24th, 25th century, but in case you wanted to, the GDP over this infinite horizon is 1,000 trillion with a T, which means that the deficit, if we want to express that in a way that would be at least somewhat meaningful, that would be 1.2%. That's right there in the trustees report. If people care about these things, let's turn to the 75-year planning period, which I think is already fairly long. We didn't know too much about 2005 back in 1930. But we'll go with 75 years, which is the official planning period. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the cost, the shortfall over the 75-year period, is equal to 0.4% of GDP. Let me say it again, 0.4%. Is that huge? Is that dire? Use all those adjectives. I enjoy it. But President Bush's tax cut was 2%. That's two, as in five times the Social Security shortfall. The share of that tax cut that went to the richest 1%, that's equal to about 6 or 7/10 of 1% of GDP. In other words, about 1.5, maybe 1.75 times the Social Security shortfall. If we want to use dire, huge, be my guest, but we're looking at things that are much more dire and huge and apparently okay with the Bush administration.
All right, we're going to take a short break. Dean Baker, when we come back, you'll get to go first. We'll also hear more from Stephen Moore and more of your calls, emails, and questions. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are some of the headlines of the stories we're following today at NPR News. The Roman Catholic Archbishop of the Iraqi city of Mosul has been kidnapped. The Archbishop was walking in front of the Al-Bashara Church in Mosul when gunmen forced him into a car and drove away. And the new president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, has ordered security forces to prevent attacks on Israelis. Israel cut ties with the Palestinian Authority after six Israelis were killed in an attack last week at a Gaza crossing point. You can hear details on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Tomorrow, we look at what works to get and keep teens out of trouble. Join guest host Lynn Neary, who will be here tomorrow, and that's on Talk of the Nation. Right now, we're continuing to talk about President Bush's proposals to revamp Social Security. Our guests are Stephen Moore, author of Bullish on Bush, How George W. Bush's Ownership Society Will Make America Stronger, and Dean Baker, co-author of Social Security, The Phony Crisis. What do you want to see to make Social Security work in the future? What changes, if any, are need to be made to get to that point? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Here's an email question from Bill Liebhart. I hear President Bush saying it will be bankrupt and people in 2042 will get nothing. I hear opponents saying they'll get 75% if nothing is done. How can this be? Who's correct and who's not getting their facts straight? Well, Dean Baker, let's start with you.
Well, it's not opponents who say that. It's actually the trustees report, which actually four of the six trustees are President Bush's political appointees. And what they say is that the system can pay all promised benefits through the year 2042. And then even if we never did anything, a very hard scenario, and they're exactly right in their projections, that people would get benefits that are equal to 75% of scheduled benefits, which is actually higher than what an average retiree gets today. Now, I should point out, using very, very slightly more optimistic assumptions, the Independent Congressional Budget Office did a separate analysis, and they concluded that the program could pay all benefits through the year 2052 with no changes whatsoever. And then even after that date, people would get about 83% of scheduled benefits. So you're welcome to choose either set of projections you might like, but in no scenario do we have a story where people in their 20s or even someone born today has to worry about there not being anything there for them. It's simply not possible.
Stephen Moore?
Well, there's two problems, I think, with that rosy analysis. One is, the big one is that there is no trust fund. And you were talking, Neil, earlier about this, but the money that has been borrowed from the fund is irretrievable. There's no getting it back. So Dean's numbers only add up if there was some way we could magically go into a bank vault and the $500 to $1 trillion that we've already borrowed from the fund were somehow available to us. But it's not. Once it's spent, it's gone forever. The second problem, and this is really, I think, for me, why the idea of these individual accounts are such a powerful idea, is that it's not just that the system is in financially bad shape. Even if you accept Dean's numbers, the real problem is it's just a lousy deal for young people to keep paying 15% of their paycheck every paycheck after paycheck and get a return on the money after 40 years that most economists believe is only 1 or 2%. If we let people have these private accounts, they're going to be able to get a rate of return even with safe investments of 4%, and that's substantially higher than 1%. So why wouldn't young workers rather have the individual account option?
Let me ask a question about something you said there, Stephen Moore, and we'll also go back to Dean Baker on
sure.
the same point. There's no money in the trust fund. The government has already borrowed it. There are bonds.
It's already spent. Neil, it's already spent.
It's already, but there are bonds.
Right.
There are physical
right.
bonds owned
right.
by the Social Security Trust Fund, $1.5 trillion, something
That's
like
right.
that. Okay.
Yes.
What you're saying
but
is, as a political choice, Congress won't want to pay that money back.
Well, what I'm saying is that where is the government going to get the money to pay back the bonds? In other words, it's almost like
right.
if I borrow money for myself.
Right. All right. Dean, where's the money? Where's the government going to get the money to pay back the bonds?
Well, Neil, my guess is you probably own some government bonds. I own some government bonds. My guess is Steve probably does. We don't ask where the government's going to get that money. Social Security is a separate program. That's under an act of Congress. Those bonds are just like any other bonds that you or I or anyone else holds. Unless, you know, Steve may want to push to have government default on its debt. It's never done that. It would be rather outrageous, I think, if it did. He's welcome to do that. I don't think he'd find a lot of takers. We should treat Social Security, as said, it's a separate program. You can't say it runs a shortfall when the taxes aren't sufficient, but when it has a surplus, we threw that money away. You know, that's nice game playing, but that's not the law. And let me just also point out, Steve said my numbers. You didn't hear my numbers. You heard the Social Security trustees' numbers. You heard CBO numbers. I'd be happy to give you my numbers some other times, but I'll just stick to the official numbers.
Here's an email question from Regina Tuskey in Huntington Woods, Michigan. I've recently heard that about Great Britain's attempt to privatize Social Security and that it didn't work. One problem is that publicly traded accounts lose about a fifth of their value to fees. Our Social Security loses 1% of its value to fees. Has anyone considered how to make up for that? Will fees be capped for retirement savings? And again, the president has not specified his proposal, but Stephen Moore in general.
Well, the way I think it would work, Neil, and as Gene was saying earlier, there are lots of plans out there. But I think the way it would probably work is that you as an individual worker and me and Dean, we would be able to choose from, let's say, one of 25 or 30 mutual funds. So we wouldn't be picking individual stocks. We'd just be picking, you know, the Fidelity Fund or the Prudential Fund or the, you know, this fund or that fund. And then those fees would be actually relatively small. You can get those fees down to about 50 basis points, which is, you know, fairly insignificant. The reason that the government doesn't have any fees attached to Social Security is it doesn't invest the money. It's almost as if they place the money under a mattress. And if that's the case, you know, you wouldn't pay any fees, but of course you don't get any return on the money either. As Albert Einstein once said, you know, the most powerful force in the universe is compound interest. And the problem with Social Security is there is no compounding of the interest because the money isn't saved. It's spent as soon as it comes in.
Dean Baker?
Well, first off, Steve's using some funny notions about where the money's coming from. Nothing drops from heaven, so his accounts, and I can go through this in more detail, it doesn't create any new money. This is just a shell game here. But in terms of the fees, that's tremendously important. We've had 15 to 20% of the money that goes into the accounts in systems like Britain. We've seen the same in Chile and other countries that have privatized their systems. 15 to 20% of what gets paid in gets taken out in administrative fees for the financial system. And I have to correct the caller. It's not 1% in the case of Social Security. It's half of 1%. And Steve, again, there's a lot of game playing. I've been around enough. I've heard it all. 50 basis points. This is on a stack of money. Let's imagine I've accumulated $10,000. I've been warned about using numbers on this show. But that's 50 basis points on that stack. What we care about is the actual flow. If we have a 50 basis points fee, that corresponds to about 8 or 9% of the money that will be flowing out of that account each year. That compares to 0.5% with Social Security. So we're talking about fees in Steve's, I think, optimistic case that are about 18 times, 16 times as much as with Social Security.
Next question comes to us from Don, who's calling from Denver.
Yes, I have two questions. The first, under Bush's plan, what happens to the insurance and disability provisions of Social Security? Second question, to avoid the maintenance cost of private accounts, why doesn't the Social Security Administration just invest a portion of the money into the market?
Okay, disability first. Why don't we put that to Stephen Moore.
Well, I believe under the president's plan, the disability program and the survivors program would be essentially unchanged. Of course, you could move towards a private investment system for those as well. I mean, the disability program is just, you know, you could just buy private disability insurance. And, of course, with the survivors benefit, it's just essentially like a life insurance program, and people could do better if they could just buy private life insurance. But on the other issue that the gentleman raised, which had to do with...
Well, why don't we do one at a time? One at a time. Okay. Dean Baker, did you want to come back on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think there's a lot of bait and switch here, because one of the beauties of the Social Security program is you have everything rolled into a single system. We have the retirement program, the survivors program, the disability program, all rolled into a single system, which allows enormous economies of scale, and we're all in this together. If you go this route of private accounts and you carry out the president's plan 20, 30, 40 years, most people are not going to care about most of the program, because most of the way he has it structured, most of their income would come from their private accounts. A very small amount of their retirement income would come from the traditional program. In that case, I would be willing to bet anything, if that passes, I'll offer odds on this, that within 10 or 15 years, if not sooner, we see the disability and survivor program at least cut back, if not privatized, as many people would like to do.
And let's put the second half of Don's question in. Don, by the way, thank you very much for the call. This is an email we got from Camille, in Charlotte, North Carolina. If investing Social Security funds is such a good idea, why doesn't the government simply invest a small percentage of the trust fund in the stock market now? Why accrue trillions of dollars in budget shortfalls and transition costs and put individuals at risk when investments could be made at little cost now?
That's a great question. I mean, if we really thought that we got money by just throwing it into the stock market, think about this for a minute. Suppose we borrowed $100 billion, right? The government borrowed $100 billion, put it in the stock market. If we really thought that created more money, we could have the government do it directly. It's the exact same story. It's the exact same story whether the government borrows $100 billion and puts it in the market itself, as opposed to the government borrowing $100 billion and telling people to do that individually, except in the second case, you have a lot more fees. And, of course, if people's retirement depends on those accounts, then there's a lot more risk. Now, frankly, that's not a way to grow the economy. It doesn't change a thing. But if we want to have that illusion, we could save a lot of money by just having the government do it directly rather than creating these accounts, then have to police over them and have these massive administrative costs.
Stephen Moore?
On the issue of – I just want to make one last point about the survivor's benefit issue, because it's one of the strongest selling points of why private accounts are so desirable. Under the private account system, let's say that you're a worker who starts working at the age of 22, and let's say you work for 35 years, and at the age of 57, you tragically have a heart attack and you die.
Mm-hmm.
Under that system with private investment accounts, you've probably accumulated $600,000 in that account. Guess what? You get to actually leave that money, because you privately own it. You get to leave that money to your heirs or your children or your favorite charity, whereas under the government-run system, they give you a small survivor's benefit, and all the money you paid into the system is lost. So that's when I think
we're running out of time. Could you answer the second part?
And on the second thing, the worst idea of all is to have the government invest it, because if you actually took the Social Security money and had the government invest it, essentially you'd have the opposite of sort of privatization. You'd have the socialization where the government would become the number one, stockholder in America. That, I think, is a very dangerous idea. I think the point that Dean is missing here is the element of private ownership, that when you own something yourself, it's very different than when the government owns it for you.
And with that, we're going to have to bring this conversation, at least temporarily, to a close. We suspect we will have to revisit it from time to time as the actual proposal comes forward and makes its way through Congress. Stephen Moore, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
Stephen Moore is president of the Free Enterprise Fund and author of Bullish on Bush, How George W. Bush's Ownership Society Will Make America Stronger. Dean Baker, appreciate your time today as well.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and co-author of Social Security, The Phony Crisis. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.